artificial intelligence will pose the greatest form of oppression that our community has ever seen before. Whether, you know, education, economics, healthcare, and so forth, criminal justice, I think technology, when it comes to artificial intelligence, is going to create the most, the deepest margins that we've ever seen or experienced before.
A lot of researchers believe that the lack of compassion and empathy that can be displayed by artificial intelligence is one of the precipices of why that occurs. My question to you is, as you employ these tools and trainings, what is the greatest thing that you've recognized is used against us from a metrics perspective as it relates to the narrative?
You know, I think that we've been lied to for a long time.
You think?
Yeah. We'll discuss race and how it plays a factor and how we didn't even talk about this topic because we were afraid.
A Black Executive Perspective.
We are coming to you live from the new BEP studio for another thought-provoking episode of a Black Executive Perspective podcast, a safe space where we discuss all matters regarding race, culture, and those uncomfortable topics people tend to avoid. I'm your host, Tony Tidbit.
And I'm your co-host, Chris P. Reed. Before we get started, we'd like to remind you to check out our partners at Code M Magazine, whose mission is saving the Black family by first saving the Black man. Check them out, CodeMMagazines2Ms.com.
Definitely check them out. And again, keep our partner, the president of Code M Magazine, Brad Boland, in your prayers. He's going through a medical situation, but he's getting stronger and better. And eventually he'll be back on the show to share exactly what's happening with Code M. But today we are joined by Mimi Styles, founder of Measure, a Just Tech Fellow, and an unapologetic data activist, for a powerful conversation about how communities of color are leading a bold data rebellion. From confronting the weaponization of metrics to demanding accountability in AI, Mimi will discuss how data in the right hands becomes a tool for liberation. We'll also explore the brilliance of HBCUs shaping the future of tech and then hitting harms of algorithmic bias and her visionary framework, which I'm definitely interested to hear about, of quantum faith, a fusion of spiritual insight and measurable strategy.
Before we get deep into this, and it's going to be deep today, I'd like to reinforce and introduce who Mimi Styles is. As the founder and president of Measure, an award-winning nonprofit using data to dismantle racial inequities that exist all around us, to include education, policing, health, and beyond. Based in Austin, Texas, Mimi has spent 15 years entrenched in the areas of community organization, research, and ethical technology. As a current Just Tech Fellow with the Social Science Research Council, Mimi integrates algorithmic bias while designing dynamic community-led frameworks for justice. She's a wife, she's a proud mother of four, she's an author of The House That the 90s Built, which serves as a love letter to Black girlhood and the culture that shaped her leadership. Through her vision of quantum faith, Mimi blends ancestral wisdom and strategic action to create a future where impact is defined and measured by us. Mimi Styles, welcome to a Black Executive Perspective podcast.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Cool. So before we jump too deep into the deep stuff, why don't you give us a little bit about you? Where do you currently reside? Where are you from? Give us a little bit about the family and them four beautiful kids.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity again to share. I am Mimi Styles. I always say that is my real name. That is why I married him. When I was 14 years old, I met my husband at a black student union dance. Our high schools were coming together, and I told him, I said, I'm going to marry you for your last name, and that is exactly what happened.
At 14, right? At 14.
I am a very intentional person. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, absolutely. I am. I'm the founder of Measure. It's a nonprofit It's a nonprofit organization that exists to really shift power through data, through storytelling, through impact measurement. It is led by Black women. We're based out in Austin, Texas. However, we work all across the nation at this point. But before doing all of that work, I mean, I was just, you know, a Black girl living in Oceanside, California with a whole lot of questions. It's a very curious person.
Well, listen, we definitely want to dive in and hear more about that Black girl and the curiosity that she had that has grown into a founder, a president, CEO of a company that's doing fantastic things. And listen, let's be fair here, too. You know, Mimi, you are in high demand. You're running a company. You're being requested to be on multiple platforms. You're traveling, like you said, a mother, a wife, four kids. So why did you want to invest the time today to come on a Black Executive Perspective podcast, talk about this topic?
I think it's always important to put us first. I mean, I let me just start with that. Yes, I am everywhere and sometimes nowhere. And at every single moment... At every single moment, my goal is to really, you know, elevate our voices. When I say our, I'm talking about the people that look like me, that understand the same oppressions that I may have had to go through or am going through in order to sit at this desk right now and to be on this podcast. And so it's really important for the retelling and sharing of thought. Within our community, it almost reminds me of our ancestors and how they would come together regularly, I'm sure, right, after a long days of hard labor and come together to remember and to share and to pass on stories for liberation. And so for me, this is what this feels like. It feels like us kind of coming together, about to deep dive into storytelling and hopefully create new paths for revolution when it comes to the executive experience.
Woo, I love that. New path, revolution. All right, so look, she seems like she's chomping at the bit, right? So Mimi, you ready to talk about it, my sister?
I stay ready.
Okay, let's talk about it.
All right, so you know, I tend to believe that every superhero has an origin story. And ironically, I met my wife when we were 13 and she intentionally hated my guts. So it definitely is not the same as your story, but still as longstanding. In your history, what brought you or what influenced you to ultimately go down this path? Can you share a little bit about your experiences that pushed you to reimagine how you wanted to tell this story and shape your destiny?
For sure. You know, I grew up in a home that was colorfully chaotic in many ways. You know, I experienced, you know, brothers who, you know, had a superpower of mental health diagnoses that were not named back in the 90s, but
right.
That really, you know, in a real interesting way of, you know, of storytelling, of trying to, you know, better understand them, right? I also grew up in a home where my father was a revolutionary. You know, my dad was a Black Panther. His father was a community organizer and did a lot for Black folk in California. My mom was a businesswoman, one of the top performing businesswomen in San Diego, California. And so I grew up in a home that embraced brilliance, that embraced Black power, and that also embraced change and empathy, right? And so that for me was really the foundation that helped me to kind of build the house of data interrogation, of care, and of empathy. And so that's really kind of that gave me the foundation to start the work that we're now 10 years in and to measure as an organization.
Give me the epiphany as to when you realize the dual function of data, where it could be presented as a weapon or as a healing tool.
For sure. Yeah. So I used to, before Measure and before me moving to Austin, Texas, I was living in El Paso, Texas, and I was working for the U.S. Army. And I was working as a person that was supporting several generals and colonels, doing network integration evaluation in the field. So we were working to protect the warfighter, in which my husband was a warfighter. He was deployed several times in the last, in several years. So my job home was really doing the deep thinking and the helping my country think about data differently. And so when we left the Army, when my husband retired, he's 100% disabled veteran. When we left the service and came into civilian life, my passion of supporting my community was really ignited during the Black Lives Matter movement, during the height of the Black Lives Matter movement.
It's time to rethink your protein. Agrilab's protein bars are crafted with high-quality protein, double the leucine, and enriched branched-chain amino acids, essential for optimal muscle recovery. Finally, a protein bar that works as hard as you do. So visit agrilabs.com and use the code BEP to get 20% off. That's agrilabs.com, promo code BEP.
My husband and I were both sitting in the living room with our kids, and we saw the marches for Mike Brown on TV. We decided, hey, let's just get up and go downtown and see how we can get involved. We did so. I think I bit off more than he expected. And so I became very much so a leader in Austin, Texas, for Black Lives, along with several other leaders. I then also realized very quickly that if we were going to make any substantial true change in the city, then it had to be data driven.
Let me ask you this. Having a father that was a Black Panther, having a mother who was a top businesswoman in California, and growing up under that roof, and then all of a sudden you see the George Floyd thing, and you're sitting in your living room, and then you jump up and like, let me get involved. So talk a little bit about the seeds that were planted when you were young, growing up in that household, that prepared you, even though you, and I don't know yet if you were doing this stuff prior to the George Floyd thing, but talk a little bit about, those seeds that sprung you to life, that was inside of you. And then you're out there doing something that your father was doing, 20, 30 years ago, okay, over another cause, but still similar in terms of, people of color, second class citizenship, being treated like any, like dogs, all that type stuff.
My dad has always taught me, like ever since I can remember, to interrogate systems of power and to reimagine them through a lens of justice. Mm-hmm. Always. I mean, I can remember conversations that I had with him, when I was calling President Reagan and I was 2 and 3 years old. I have a memory that's just out of this world, to be honest with you. But I literally remember these conversations and sitting there and, maybe they were way too young. I was way too young for these types of convos, but my dad gave them to me anyway, okay?
Right.
His trauma and all his own, reckoning. And a daughter that would listen, I had always been that girl. Okay. And that also kind of led me to in elementary school. I mean, I led my first, what I call my first revolution, right? I had this weird understanding of black and white And I was going through the lunch line at Pacifica Elementary School, and I looked down at, you know, where I can choose my milk, and it was just the white milk. And I said to myself, huh, you know, and I was tiny, tiny kid, there should be chocolate milk too. Why do we only have to have white milk? And so I came home and I told my dad, Dad, you know, I just realized, you know, we should also have chocolate milk instead of just white milk. There should be brown milk too. And my dad, you know, in all his brilliance, said, yes, go fight the power, you know, because he knew that that was just a seed. So he's like, go do everything that you can, you know, bring, get people together. He really taught me a lot about collectivism in that very young age, and me really leading this movement. And to be honest with you, I did it. I went ahead and I started collecting names, and I did a petition. I had children, very young, just like myself, marching to the principal's office, Mr. Dodd. I remember him very vividly. You know, and he, you know, he went ahead and signed my petition with me, and, you know, we raised get chocolate milk inside of the, you know, in the lunchroom. And, you know, I mean, they've since gentrified my neighborhood, but, you know, ever since then, I'm sure that there were kids sugared up ready for, you know, before math time because of me. But, you know, again, my dad has always been that guy to really just kind of push me to believe in my voice. So I've never doubted my voice, if that makes any sense. And I think that's kind of what happens sometimes, is that, you know, the world teaches us or the world has taught us, you know, in communities of color, that we don't have power from all the things that we have seen. And right. And so when you have that positive, affirming foundation, parents, fathers, especially, I'm going to say for Black girls, very important role. Affirming your voice, allowing you to kind of believe in it at an early age. I think that really gave me what I needed in order to be who I am today.
As you went from being a young Spike Lee to realizing that technology could help you in your plight.
Buddy, when was that? Angela Davis. She was a young Angela Davis, all right? Not Spike Lee, thinking, though, right?
Davis. She did the milk thing I was thinking about. Ain't no brothers on the wall.
Ain't no brothers on the wall.
But
to be fair, though, real quick, though, when she said the milk thing, to be honest, it took me back when I was in kindergarten, right? Okay. And same thing. And I would only, Mimi, when you, it's just, I was like, wow. I would just get chocolate milk. I don't know why. And we had to pay for it, not to pay extra nickel, right? But I would just do, seriously, all jokes aside. But go ahead, finish your thoughts, Chris, your question.
Oh, no, but I was wondering, because technology, you know, relatively is, at least at the way in which it's used now, is a newer thing. It's not something that you had in your childhood, and you had to augment technology to these philosophies and these theories that your dad had imbued in you. When did you realize the marriage was required for you to take this flight forward and make sure that you continued the march?
Yeah, you know, here's the thing, though, and not to counter what you're saying, but technology, I feel, has always been here, right?
Okay.
There's an organization here in Austin that says community is the best form of technology. And as I think about that, you know, I think that technology has always been, you know, the infrastructure of change, whether that technology was us, you know, was starting a fire or creating a wheel or developing, you know, ways in which to move massive, you know, pieces of brick from one end to the next in order to build the pyramids. You know, technology has always been here. If you really, you know, I've been kind of deep diving into code and where even code came from, and some, you know, the binary code and so forth. And you would be surprised to learn that, you know, some of that code has even come from, you know, the way the cotton gin was developed and created, right? Today's computers based on that same sort of methodology. And so when we think about technology, it's so embedded in who we are as people, especially Black folk, right? As, you know, the Moors and the developer and the creators of mathematical ingenuity and so forth, and genius, like, we've always been this, right? And so all I've done, to be honest with you, is created a platform where our genius is recognized. And in fact, Black women, you know, being always in the background when it comes comes to sending men to the moon, or, you know, as we've just seen, we are the unhidden figures. And so that's why I'm excited to be able to have a team of Black women that are data activists. That's what we call ourselves, or data activists, right? As we design code and as we design new technology, and as we interrogate artificial intelligence, we do it with a sense of obligation to our ancestors, right? Because this technology has always been within us. And so that's all I feel like I'm doing, is really just kind of tapping into who we've always been. Ida B. Wells, right? One of the first data activists, the woman who went around and documented the atrocities and the hangings of our people, and because she did it, liberated our people in many ways, and exposed hate and exposed the demonic forces behind white supremacy. And so, yeah, again, I see myself as just another sounding board that, you know, God has chosen in order to speak and to show the brilliance of black folk.
So, Mimi, that is awesome. Tell us a little bit, based on that, tell us a little bit about what you do and you and your team do at Measure. And then talk a little bit about what systems were you set out to disrupt, and what systems did you want to build instead?
Sure. Yeah. So at Measure, we absolutely 100% believe that communities have the answers when it comes to some of the systems of oppression that we have experienced in our world, right? So education injustices, healthcare injustices, economic injustices, and that it does also take tools in order for us to be heard. So at Measure, we provide free data and evaluation tools to powerful Black, Brown, and Indigenous-led organizations, as well as everyone else that have equity goals, right? We support our community through data. This is just one gift that we have at Measure that we're bringing to the village. And so we create those tools. We create culturally responsive research, right? So I'm a social scientist, and I believe in lived experience as data, as rich qualitative data. I also embrace, you know, quantitative data as a mixed methods approach, so that when we gather the voices and the experiences and are able to see that with the numbers, then we can really create strategies and solutions that our communities can believe in. Measure is also big on coalition building, right? We bring the right people together in order to create change. We use our evaluative method called the CARE model. So it's CARE, Community Advocacy, Resilience, and Evidence. And this is a model that we developed with our community for our community. So essentially, you know, I was told, hey, Mimi, we need you to go out into this community and go build bridges and you know, help us to identify what we need to do to create trust. And I said, well, how are we going to go do all that when we don't even understand relationship, right? And we need a method. We need to go in with care. And as I was writing that down, that's when I started thinking about, okay, what does care really mean? And what does it mean to evaluation and research and design? And so that's really where that CARE model came from. And so that's what Measure does. We've so far supported over 90 organizations, mostly Black and Brown led organizations, and helping them to create their data, their metrics, knowing what to measure in order to see success in their programming. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. Let's break it down even further. Like, give me an example in terms of a company or a community, whatever the case may be, where you guys, they said, hey, this is our issue. And then you guys came in and implemented the data and stuff to help them grow. Give us an example of that, what that looks like.
Yeah, I can give you a couple examples. The first one, let me just start with us again. There's an organization called Man and Me. It's in Austin, Texas, and this organization exists to just support fathers, right? They just, you know, bring guys together that just need, you know, support in each other. And they were wondering, you know, what do they measure in order to see success within their programming? And so we used the care model with this organization. We were able to go back in time and time travel with them, right? And to name some things that were important for this organization and for the men that they serve. And what that resulted in was a set of metrics, of qualitative, quantitative metrics that we call community impact metrics, right? CIMs. And one of those metrics was really the percentage of fathers that feel more connected to their community. That was their metric of success. It wasn't about how much they raise and funding and da-da-da. It was about the men that come into their room that then feel connected to one another and to their community. And that, if they feel connected, then they feel more empowered as fathers. And so that was really interesting to see. Another one that was really important, and it's not with a Black-led organization, but for the city of Pflugerville, right? This is a city that's right outside of Austin, Texas. In fact, I live here. We worked with the city of Pflugerville and used the CARE model once again. And what that produced was a commission, was a brand new, what they call the equity commission. They needed to know what do they need to do to support their community, which in, 18%, this is a majority, person of color community. Notice I didn't say majority minority because I don't believe in minority. I feel like that is a word that's used to once again continue to oppress us with language that does not make sense. And so, but it is essentially a commission now that governs how they show up in a more equitable and equal way within the community.
I love it. Talk a little bit about, tell us data rebellion. Tell us a little bit, what does data rebellion mean and how do you guys use it?
I think that it's, that sits with a project that we have just been awarded with the Robert Woods Johnson's Foundation. So I am, one of those Black women in at Measure. I say we are the Black women that are charged with interrogating artificial intelligence right now. So they've provided us a grant of, $712,000 to help to develop out anti-bias methodology when it comes to utilizing artificial intelligence within our community. And so what that means is that I am a data rebel, right? I am not going to just sit and believe what the robots tell us. So when so many of us right now are so incredibly dependent already in just a very small amount of time on artificial intelligence. And so if we are going to continue the rapid pace of adoption, then we have to make sure that what we adopt is going to be healthy, is going to be supportive, and is not going to further or deepen the margins of oppression. I have a suspicion that is already starting to be proven that artificial intelligence will pose the greatest form of oppression that our community has ever seen before. Whether, education, economics, healthcare, and so forth, criminal justice, I think technology, when it comes to artificial intelligence, is going to create the most, the deepest margins that we've ever seen or experienced before.
A lot of researchers believe that the lack of compassion and empathy that can be displayed by artificial intelligence is one of the precipices of why that occurs. My question to you is, as you employ these tools and trainings, what is the greatest thing that you've recognized is used against us from a metrics perspective as it relates to the narrative?
I think that we've been lied to for a long time.
You think?
Somebody lied to us. They told a story that does not make any sense.
They're still telling stories.
They are.
To be like Tony would say, to be fair, is there one big beautiful lie that you could identify with?
Don't give me out no politics. I don't want to hear it.
My girl, we talk about everything here. Tell us what time it is. All right. Don't hold back. You on BEP. All right.
Yeah, no, someone told us a lie, you know, someone told our people a lie. And that lie has been measured in ways that have harmed us and so deeply. I mean, when I like to be this who I am. I like to be right. A researcher, because researchers in many cases were the ones who documented the lie, right? There was a researcher back in the day that explained a word that gave language of drapetomania. Drapetomania was a condition, a medical condition that was proven, right? As air quotes, all right, to explain why a Black human would try to escape the plantation that they were on. Drapetomania, this was proven medical evidence, right? And so when I say that the importance of us being researchers and uncovering the truth, re-uncovering the truth, is critical to who we are today. And here's the other piece about this. We had generations and years and just so much time of Black people, right, having power and in fact the inventors of so many powerful tools and stories and, you know, kingdoms and so forth. But the erasure came. There was a moment in time where erasure came, right? And to whereas many African Americans have no concept of the power in which we actually, that who we are. And so I foresee today that erasure, once again, right, we were able to uncover a little bit, right? And we've been able to kind of come together as a community, but I foresee the erasure coming again, the second wave of erasure, meaning all the, you know, all the atrocity that has happened to us, you know, our Martin Luther Kings, our Malcolm X's, our, you know, all the people, the voices, myself, right? They've already started to try to mute my own voice, right?
Right, right,
so
right.
The erasure that comes with technology is now posing once again, kind of sort of like that second wave. And so when it comes to what we need to do right now, it is embracing the opportunity of artificial intelligence to serve us, right? We cannot be subjected to the potential of it erasing us once again.
Correct. So correct.
The issue with technology, or I'm sorry, computer technology, because I know you use technology in a different semantic, but in technology from a computer space and the artificial intelligence concept of it, it's garbage in, garbage out. As you said, it's deemed by who programs it and then who proliferates it. If you were to then have control of artificial technology or artificial intelligence and be able to utilize that tech to benefit us, what would that look like? Because once again, one man's trash is another man's treasure. So as you feel like your stories and your programming is a treasure to the community and to the world, someone consider that to be trash. So how do you navigate that?
So that's the big question that we are asking ourselves in the project that we're doing right now, right? Okay. We're leading a team of Black researchers, mostly women, and community members to really build an AI equity database that has metrics and measures of more so particularly health AI metrics, right? Like metrics that could potentially help to help us navigate the health system a little bit better. We're also training evaluators when it comes to bias auditing. That's a big piece of this project, is coming up with methods of bias auditing, right? So we're using technology in order to better understand how bias exists in generative AI outcomes, and how, if we convene communities together as jurors, right, juries or voices, like a coalition of voices, to be able to correct, to say, yes, that was right when that generative AI output came, or no, that was not right, and this is why, and be, you know, help to work with the technologists who've created these systems to let them know, this is not acceptable in our community in the way that this generative AI output came. And this is a better way to say it through our own language and our own experiences. At some point, by continuing to do that and by creating that framework, we can ultimately help to shape how AI is held accountable, especially in communities that are most impacted by marginalization. So that's sort of the idea. And I'm coming up with this concept called the theory of interrogative reasoning, right? Which says that we don't just need a human in the loop. That is a common term when it comes to AI accountability, is the human in the loop. But instead, my theory proposes that we need humans in the loop, humans that are close to particular problem that the generative AI is trying to solve.
Yeah. And I'm glad you guys are doing that. Do you know Aaron Reddick at all?
I know the name.
So she was on our show a few months back, and
Black ChatGPT, correct?
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Okay.
On the same email chain for quite some time.
Yeah, we'll connect you, right? But that's my girl, and you guys are doing the same. She's doing the same thing that you guys are looking to do, right? Because, you know, like she said, and we did a little demonstration on the show where she typed into regular ChatGPT the top 10 influential people in the United States. You can imagine who came up. It was everybody in Trump's cabinet. Okay. And then she asked the same question to Chat Black GPT. So she created that chatbot to make sure that we're not erased out of it. Okay. And it's for the Black community, and she's looking to take it to the next level. So I love what you're doing. My question is, and it's the same question I had for her. And we just had another gentleman on, Chris Jackson, yesterday. And he's big into our community, really diving into AI. And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked them. You all, which Chris and I agree with 100%, the importance of it, the importance to be aware of it, the importance that it is trying to erase us. And you took it to a whole nother level where you figure that this is going to be the biggest oppressor ever. Okay. And I don't disagree with anything that all of you guys say. My question is, why isn't more people of color getting involved or embracing AI? All right. Because there's a big fear. Nobody, you talk to them, they're like, what are you talking about? Or I don't believe in that. Or I don't want them to steal nothing. It's just a level of ignorance. And to be fair, the power base wants them to be ignorant about it, doesn't want them to engage about it, because then it's easier to move them out of it. So let me hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always kind of think about the technological gap that we experienced, you know, even before the emergence of, you know, the ChatGPTs of the world. There's always existed. We've always seen a major gap of access, right? And of literacy. So with access and literacy already being a problem in our community, I believe that, you know, with generative AI now being the new thing, it just exacerbates it, right? And so again, we have to put blame to where blame is due, and that is on the system of oppression. That's on systems of racism. It's us not having the opportunity to be at the table to design these systems, to, you know, to be kind of at the forefront. What I do see that's hopeful right now is that we are seeing Black folk really leaning forward when it comes to AI, right? I mean, even if it's just as funny as like these videos on you know, on TikTok. Dancing with their ChatGPT person, or like, you know, just even if it's just, you know, comical and kind of funny, what I see in the background is like, I see a community embracing a technology that could potentially provide and also provide a sense of equity, right? When we are now seeing, you know, Black businesses pop up here that are AI driven, just with Aaron Reddick and like different, right, you know, people that are embracing this opportunity of technology. And so there's now we do have the chance to really kind of embrace this tool. To me, it's really about creating the platform for us to get excited about it. And so for, you know, I'm also the chairwoman of the HBCU AI Con, right? And this HBCU AI conference and training summit is something that takes place at Houston Tillotson University, historically Black college and university, right here in Austin, Texas. In fact, it's the first institution of higher learning here in Austin, Texas. And so by creating a platform for AI literacy, for AI learning, in other words, it's bringing our community together. You know, to be honest with you, you know, Tony and Chris, this work for me, it is personal, right?
Personal, tell us, why is it personal?
It's personal because first, you know, I have seen the impacts of technological injustice, right? I know what can happen to a person that has, that is being taken advantage of through AI algorithms that can tap into the worst parts of them, right? So if you have a person, for example, I'm a mama that is the mama of an incarcerated Black boy, Black man now, and so who has also experienced, you know, the harms of technology and what it does to a person when they are suffering from mental illness or from psychosis, right? And how AI algorithms and algorithms in general can harm them. That's why it's personal for me. I need to develop out and create some sort of guardrails for one day when my son is home and he picks up his laptop computer again, or he picks up his cell phone again, then he will be able to have a system that is not going to harm him, right?
Right.
Seeing the harms of people being pulled over because of license plate readers that are ineffective. I've seen harms of Black people not being able to be seen by facial recognition, or being missing, right?
There you go. Exactly. 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 Misidentified.
That's the word I was right. looking for, you know, or just, you know, so What this means for me is that whether it's through technology, whether it's through policy, whether it's through the development of, you know, new algorithms or new sets of training data in which, you know, some of the work that we're doing, it's about our worth as Black folk, right? It's about our health. It's about our freedom. It's about us being able to truly kind of actualize the dream of Dr. King. And with us being the ones that are building the technology, right? That is where I believe that dream can come true.
You talked about introducing for a level of accountability. You called it AI accountability, okay? And in the accountability aspect of it, where we live in a world where accountability has been diminished significantly, let's just be honest, people are less and less likely to be accountable and run from accountability. But also you saying you want to introduce a level of what I, you know, kind of took as a human blockchain.
If you like what you hear and want to join us on this journey of making uncomfortable conversations comfortable, please subscribe to a Black Executive Perspective podcast on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe now to stay connected for more episodes that challenge, inspire, and lead the change.
To audit the AI output, proponents of AI would say that AI gives you a plethora of options, and ultimately it is the human arbiter on the other side that chooses said option to go forward with. What would you say to that, as opposed to them? Because a lot of this is Skynet, right? It's the Terminator. And we're just following the gospel of the computer. Whatever the computer says, it can't be wrong. It's infallible. And we're going to do whatever. You can't blame me because the computer said he was guilty. The computer said I should do this and I should take that action. What do you say to those people that are defending the computer or the AI, saying that all it does is give you what it can and you have to then execute or activate?
I would say, look at where those people are, you know, what are they trying to, let me just put it this way. I would say
I have my own thought. I want to hear your thought because I have my own thoughts. Well, go ahead.
Okay.
Those folks are probably trying to increase their pocketbook. So there's two forms of technology, right? There is technology that is, you know, that's being built for capitalistic reasons.
Yes.
And then there are public interest technologies, PIT, right? Okay. I would say, you know, look up the Centers for Public Interest Technology. This is another form of technology that's being built out. And what I've even told the folks that are ahead, that are, you know, that kind of run this organization, Centers for Public Interest Technology, if the technology has been built with an idea of making money, there will be compromises that will be made.
There's no question. Along the way.
I think that's why it's important that organizations that are, number one, nonprofit organizations or organizations that are led especially by people like Aaron Reddick, that have an understanding of oppression, that have an understanding of extreme marginalization, right, are the ones that are creating large language models that are more conscious, right, that where she can, you know, kind of include empathetic reasoning.
Correct.
Right. That's why it's just so critical, once again, for us being at the table, for us being the developers, the designers, so that we can design for our great, great, great granddaughters.
Correct. And then more importantly, the computer. So, and to your point, Chris, I get you when you say garbage in, garbage, whatever they put in. But if you don't have a pushback to that, they can input that this race is the most dominant and everybody else is byproducts of, right? And then obviously the technology will take that and run with it, okay? And then so now you have generations and generations of people coming after us that now have no clue of where they came from, what their history is about, who did what, whatever the case may be. So that's the other, forget the, you know, and I get it. And I was going to say, in all those movies, the Skynet, it crashed. Okay. In every one of those movies, the computer was supposed to be dominant, but it failed. And that's always going to be the case, right? But the one thing that doesn't fail is faith. Okay. And I want to go to quantum faith. Talk to a little bit about quantum faith.
Well, I can't talk about quantum faith unless I kind of elevate the name Lily Milliner. So this is
okay.
I look at her as my mentor when it comes to quantum AI and the understanding of quantum spirituality. And Lily Milliner, she has been doing this work for decades and decades. And, you know, I had talked to her about participating in what's called the Quantum AI Literacy Conference. And this happened in Atlanta last year. And we just really, you know, I had said something about, gosh, I just don't have enough time. You know, there's just not enough time in the day. And she said, well, what do you mean by that, Mimi? And I'm like, I just have so much to do and not enough time. And she says, well, Mimi, that is actually not true. She says, you know, we serve a God that exists outside of time. He says he is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. There is no start and no finish.
No question.
When I when I think about, you know, time as a resource, I also have to then kind of think about quantum computing and quantum AI, right? If we were, we've been so used to this, the, you know, binary code of 0101, 0101, 0101. But then when you think about quantum AI, what it, how it exists and how it, you know, is built is the 0, 1, right? And so you're talking about, no limits. When you think about abundance, when you think about, you know, the existence of everything and everywhere and so forth, that's where I kind of connect this idea of quantum spirituality. You know, in the Word of God, it said that if we had faith as small as a mustard seed, right? And that mustard seed being the smallest thing that they, that, you know, that, that could be understood as like matter, right? Mm-hmm. A mustard seed. But now we know that the smallest piece of matter is an atom, right? Mm-hmm. So if we have faith as small as an atom, which is microscopic, you cannot see it with the human eye, then we can move mountains. And so that's the type of faith that I seek to, that I seek to kind of hold on to, that I seek to believe in, is a faith that is quantum. That if I can believe and see my great, great, great granddaughter who is liberated and respected and loved in her rest as a Black woman, you know, 150 years from today, then I know that even my son who's incarcerated right now will be okay. And so when I think about this idea of quantum spirituality, I just think about who God really is and who God has always told us, you know, he is, or she is, in some sense, some folks may say. And so it's really just about being able to have a belief in a system of spirituality that has no bounds, that does not exist in scarcity, right? And we have been taught so often and so heavily on existing in scarcity, the rat race. We have to, you know, this person's going to take your jobs. AI is going to take your jobs. You know, all of this fear. My mom told me yesterday, the opposite of faith is fear, right? And so I choose not to fear, and I choose to believe that I can have faith as small as an atom. And because I have faith in something as small as an atom, then it is unboundless. And that I can, you know, that we can develop a system, even in technology, right? Mm-hmm. That serves us.
You're embodying something that is antithetical to me as a historian, how people were for years as it relates to the evolution of science, who were called heretics, versus spirituality and faith and religion, right? So spirituality, religion being a different dynamic. How do you personally create that balance and proliferate that balance in the people that you speak with to say, I can be a scientist and I can have a strong conviction in my belief in my faith? Because forever, that was not allowed. That was not, and people were stoned and killed for what you're trying to do right now.
They said stoned and killed. That's true. She's a witch.
You're the man. You ain't lying.
She's a witch.
Y'all about to be looking at my spaghetti now.
Huh? Right.
You know, that's a good, it's a really good question. It's something that I think about, that I pray about all the time. Okay. I know who I am in my walk with the Lord. Right. And I know that God has given me something that that he's called me to share about. And, you know, just like how, you know, they said Harriet Tubman, you know, had dreams and that she had visions, and that, you know, they said that, you know, many folks in our own community who have been revolutionaries, you know, called on a higher power or saw sights and heard things. Right.
Absolutely.
And so I just choose not to autocorrect. Okay. So this is, that's just, you know, I choose not to autocorrect, and I believe that God honors that. Right. I believe in faith that is of our God, and I can say that, and I can profess that as a scientist, right? Mm-hmm. Both can be true. Just again, with quantum AI and spirituality and quantum computing, both can be true. All things can exist at one time, and I feel like
exactly
why I exist in this same space. And you know, it's weird because when I was a little girl, I used to dream of. And it was really odd, but I would have a reoccurring dream all the time. And I was young, and I would be on a battlefield, and I would be negotiating from one end of, you know, the fight to the other. And I would go back and forth and negotiate and negotiate and negotiate. And this was me at 5, 6, 7 years old, having these types of dreams. And so I knew that I was at some point in my life going to be that negotiator. I don't think that negotiation means compromise, though. I don't think that they're the same things. I think that it's a space where both things can actually be true. I can be 100% a believer in my God, and I can also be 100% a person that has an understanding of the possibilities of science.
I love it. I love it. And I love the, how should I say, you know, this old saying, you know, you can speak things into existence. The power of the tongue, and then the vision, right? Being able to see what you believe your destiny is, right? And you're a born leader, okay? And you were seeing that, and you were 5 years old. So my final question I have for you, what's the one thing that every person of color should remember when they're stepping into leadership?
I think that, first of all, that old saying, you know, heavy is the head. That's true.
It's lonely at the top.
Right. I think that is all true. And I think that it is important for every person that's stepping into leadership to find your herd. Find your herd. Find for women, okay, particularly, and I think this is true for men too, but for women, can speak from my own understanding, is find your elephant herd. There is the way that elephants exist in the wild, female elephants, is that when one of them is sick, or one of them is giving birth, or one of them is in pain, then all of the other elephants in their herd will circle around her, right? As she lay in the middle. And they'll stomp around her as she's giving birth, and they will kick up dust in order to distract any enemy that seeks to harm her or, you know, devour her. And so I have been lucky enough to find my herd. These are a group of other Black women CEOs in Austin, Texas, and I'll say their name. You know, Dr. Melva Wallace, the president of Houston Tillotson University, Pamela Benson Owens, this, you know, a big time CEO, Terry P. Mitchell, Sharonda Robinson, owners of Austin Women's Magazine, Kiko Anderson, attorney at law, you know, and just women that we've come together as peacemakers for one another, so that when things arise, because they will in leadership, then you have a small community of elephants that'll kick up dust for you.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah, that is, man, this whole thing has been extremely, extremely powerful. My question to you as we, you know, wrap up here is, if in your message and in your movement, you had one final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners today, that if I was starting from scratch, what is the thing that I would want to hear from Mimi Styles and her folks, her coalition, or her pack of elephants? What is the one thing that I should pay attention to and lean in on?
Give yourself, you know, rest. Start with rest. How are you going to rest in your work? Even in your project management. And as you build out a new system, or if you build out a new, you know, program or project, how are you going to incorporate your rest in it. Because no matter what, this world going to keep going. It's going to keep spinning without you. The job is going to be there. AI is going to keep on growing, right? But how are you sustaining yourself? How are you prioritizing your ability to rest? Because as we rest, we're able to dream. And if we're able to dream, then we can actually innovate. And so that's what I would want people to lean into.
I love that. That is awesome. So, matter of fact, I feel like taking a nap now. All right, but it's all good. So, Mimi, how can a Black Executive Perspective podcast help you, my sister?
I think number one is to, first of all, use chat Black GPT, number one. Instead of using the regular, you know, GPT, use that. And to support my sister, Erin Reddick, I think that's number one, right? Because as we continue to support that algorithm and that large language model, it'll continue to see us. So that's number one. I also think that, you know, support Black-led research. Measure is looking to partner with a couple of, you know, great organizations that are interested in really intentionally supporting the topic of AI interrogation. So reach out to me, follow our work at wemeasure.org. It's wemeasure.org. And then also on social media at, you know, at wemeasureus. That is our kind of social media handle. But I, you know, it's really about, you know, build community with us. Let's all, you know, we all have something to bring to the table, and what can we do to support what it is that you're doing?
My girl, that's an easy thing. You know, what's the, remember in the movie, The Ten Commandments, they used to say, so let it be written, let it be done. All right. So that's an easy thing to do. And we're going to, more importantly, you've blessed us today. With your passion and your love of your fellow human being. Obviously, you're a highly intelligent lady, and you got a, and I can imagine the group of elephants and your team of women that's building out really spaces and tech for people of color and helping companies be able to measure exactly what they need to take it to the next level. And so is, I know you're busy, you're all over, so for you to spend a couple minutes with us today and bless us with your presence, you know, God always says, you know, I learned this a long time ago, how does God bless people? God blesses people through people, okay? And so you coming on here today, you blessed us, and you're going to bless our audience. So in terms of a partnership with a Black Executive Perspective podcast, that was done before you even came on the show. You and I chatted. You already know what time it is, okay? So we're already good, and we're going to connect. And I'm going to get you, don't worry, I'm going to connect you with Erin right after this. So Mimi Styles, CEO, President of Measure, thank you for appearing on a Black Executive Perspective podcast.
Thank you. Always welcome.
So I think it's now time for
Tony's Tidbit.
And so the tidbit today, we are not just disrupting systems. We're designing futures rooted in truth, equity, and faith. Because justice isn't about breaking what's broken. It's about rebuilding what never existed. And when it comes to technology, we're not afraid of the algorithm. We're here to reprogram it to encode our values, our voices, and our vision into the systems that shape tomorrow. And you heard a lot of that from our sister, Mimi Styles.
At this time, as we close this, we want to remind you to tune in to Need to Know with Nasinga, where our person, Dr. Nasinga Burton, you know, brings powerful, poignant, insightful impact to our community and topics that shape our world. Make sure you tune in each week to Dr. Nasinga Burton with Need to Know with Nasinga.
Absolutely. And you don't want to miss the next episode of Pull Up, Speak Up. Our roundtable sits down and talks and discusses the provocative topics that's happening in the world today. This is where bold, unfiltered voices tackles these issues with sharp perspectives, real talk, and a call to action. This is not just an episode, it's a revolution. Actually, we're going to get Mimi to be on one of our roundtables. So don't forget to check out the next Pull Up, Speak Up here on the Black Executive Perspective podcast.
And here we remember to incorporate LESS. You know, we have a call to action here where our goal is to eliminate all forms of discrimination. And to achieve this, we're asking everyone to embrace less, LESS. and the L stands for learn. Educate yourself on racial and cultural nuances and what time it is now, as Mimi talked about today. Make sure that you learn as much as you can to be forewarned and forearmed for the future.
Absolutely. And then after you learn, you have the letter E that stands for empathy. Now, since you've been enlightened on different people that you don't know about and their cultural nuances, now you can be more empathetic to what they deal with because you can put yourself in their shoes.
The first S stands for share. Share your insights and enlighten others. Help to enrich your community with information so that you all collectively can be better.
Absolutely. And the final S is stop. We want to, you want to stop discrimination as it walks in your path. So if Aunt Jenny or Uncle Joe says something that's inappropriate at the Sunday dinner table, you say, Aunt Jenny, Uncle Joe, we don't believe that. We don't say that. And you stop it right there. So if everyone can incorporate less, L-E-S-S will build a more fair, understanding world, and we all will see the change that we want to see because less will become more.
This was a very impactful and powerful episode for me specifically because I learned a lot about the balance and creating an opportunity for rest and recuperation. But tune into our other episodes that we have. We mentioned an episode here where we talked about the chat Black GPT dynamic, and that was a powerful episode. So we'll have future episodes. Make sure you go to our website, sign up for the newsletter. Make sure that you review and give us insights on what you would like for us to talk about so we can meet you where you are and subscribe. And where can they find us, Tony?
My friend, you can find the Black Executive Perspective Podcast on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And you can follow us on our socials of LinkedIn, X, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, at a Black Exec. For our fabulous guest, the CEO, president, founder of Measure, Mimi Styles. For my boy down in Dallas, the co-host with the most, Chris P. Reed, I'm Tony Tidbit. We talked about it. We learned about it. We laughed about it. We still going to strive about it, and we're going to thrive about it. We love you, and guess what? We're out.
A Black Executive Perspective.